Hello, welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. My name's John Burns, and this is an edition of my podcast for folk who like the outdoors. It's getting pretty chilly and pretty dark up here in the Highlands right now. So as winter is rapidly winging its way, so we're going to see what sort of a winter we'll get. My guest today is an author. He's obviously a climber. And a filmmaker and an expert on filming safety, and has worked in a lot of films. He's just written a book called High Risk, and I think it's a fascinating book about some of the big names in climbing who were around in what I think everyone thought was a golden age of Himalayan climbing in the 1970s. So I'd like to introduce Brian Hall. Hi, Brian. How are you?
Yeah, hi, John. Good to speak to you. It's good that we could get this arranged before the weekend, and I'm keen to have a chat to your audience about my book and about what I wrote about. So,
Fantastic. Good to speak to you. I've just realised, we're okay. Well, tell me about the period that you wrote about. I mean, it was in the 70s, and it was, if I'm right in sort of recalling, considered to be one of the golden ages of Himalayan exploration, when there was a lot of first climbs to be done and a lot of people who were able to do them. Is that a fair sort of summary of that age?
It is a fair summary. What the book is really, it's more like about 16 years, really, from 1969, when I went to university in Leeds, through to my last big expedition in 1986 on K2. And really, that is when I was operating at the top end of what was possible for me anyway. Firstly as an alpinist, and then as a Himalayan mountaineer, and really, you mentioned the word golden age. I don't know whether it is the golden age, but it's certainly a golden age, because I'm sure everybody who participates in a particular era think it was fantastic and they really enjoyed it. So certainly it was my golden age of Himalayan mountaineering. Carry on. Yeah, yeah.
Well, just going to ask you, what do you think were the most notable achievements of mountaineers and climbers in that period?
Well, that's a really good question, because the significant part of the early part of that era was that there was a massive change in the way that we climbed Himalayan mountains, and I was part of that change. And that's part of, that's really is there's several strands to the book High Risk, Climbing to Extinction, and one of them is about this change. So if some of the people in your audience can remember that far back, for example, in 1970, Chris Bonington led an expedition to Annapurna, and they succeeded in making a fantastic ascent of the South Face, which was regarded as one of the hardest things ever done in mountaineering. And then 5 years later, Chris Bonington again led an expedition to climb what was regarded again as the last great problem in Himalayas. It was always a last great problem, isn't there? But this was the Southwest Face of Everest. And that had been tried a few times in the early 70s, and it was finally completed. And not only that, it put the first British people on the summit of Everest. Dougal Haston and Doug Scott reached the summit. So it was very notable, and it received a lot of accolades and press. But those expeditions really were, heavyweight expeditions. They involved over a dozen people, a dozen top-end climbers, oxygen, fixed ropes, camps, spent over several months to conquer the mountains. And this was done in a very militaristic way, really well organized, Film crews, base camp managers, lots of Sherpas carrying loads. And this was the model of the way that expeditions had been run, really, since, well, for a long, long time, right the way back going through to Mallory and Irvine on the north side of Everest. And all the 8,000 meter peaks had been climbed in that way, and many of the significant lower peaks in the 7,000 meters had been climbed. And the other thing that these expeditions were, they were national expeditions. So there were, you know, the Italians climbed K2 first, the Brits climbed Everest first.
Yeah.
So this was the case in 1975 when I started rock climbing and then alpine climbing. And in 1975, there was a massive change in the way that we climbed. And I was part of that change.
Yeah, so you're talking really about the transition between, I think, what used to be called siege tactics, where, well, as you say, it was a massive expedition. People would set up very methodically camps on a mountain and supply those camps, which took a lot of Sherpas. And then there was the transition that you're talking about, I think, is that right, across to what they called alpine style, where expeditions were much, much lighter weight and far fewer people and moved a lot faster. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And what happened with these big siege tactics, as you put it, or heavyweight expeditions, was that perhaps only a small number of people got to the summit, and lots of the other members were just, you know, load carrying, and some of them were quite happy with that, but other people were a little bit disillusioned that they'd gone on an expedition and didn't get to the top. So what was happening, and it wasn't just happening in my group of friends. I mean, there was a caucus of about 20 or so people, and we all knew each other in the 70s.
Yeah.
We're all going to the Alps together. We made the transition from rock climbing and climbing in Scotland in winter, honing our skills at ice climbing, which we then used in the Alps in the summer. And then from the Alps in the summer, we started to go to the Alps in the winter, which is a big step forward and really hadn't been done by British people before. It was the domain of the continentals, really. And it was a big step up then, because the Alps in winter at that time, before global warming, were really, really cold. And you went from doing day routes in the summer to doing like multi-day routes in the Alps in winter, because the days were shorter. Mm-hmm. You had to take a lot more kit because it was a lot colder. So all of these, we were getting more and more expert. And there, at that time, well, I think it was in 1969, there was a guy called Lito Tejera Flores, wrote a definitive article in the In Ascent. This guy was American, and he got published in Mountain Magazine very early on in this famous publication, Mountain Magazine, which started in '69. And basically, this article was called Games Climbers Play. And Games Climbers Play defined a series of steps in climbing and really shows to quite easily to both the layman and the expert how climbing works. That it's not one sport, it's a series of sub-sports. Mm-hmm. You start off on bouldering, then going rock climbing, then multi-pitch rock climbing, then Scottish or ice climbing, summer alpine, winter alpine, and then finally out to the greater ranges, the Himalayan climbing. And each step requires a greater commitment and more gear, and it's harder to do, and you need more training, and significantly more things can go wrong. You know, you're not going to generally get avalanched or fall in a crevasse when you're rock climbing, you know, but alpine climbing you are. And when you go to the Alps, you're generally not going to die of altitude sickness. So all these various steps, as you go up the ladder of the games climbers play, you're getting more and more committed and going into and taking higher risks. And this is part of the story. My book is called High Risk.
Yes,
we were taking a journey into higher risks as we moved from my early days of rock climbing in the Lake District through to winter climbing in Scotland, then the Alps, and then winter climbing in the Alps, finally to the great to the Himalayas. So what we were doing was following that, and the book analyzes really why we did that and why we accepted the risks that that as we went up that ladder of commitment. Why we did it, and did we realize that about our mortality, should we say? And so to put it to join the circle, as it were, so round about 1975 we were climbing in the Alps in the winter and wanting a bigger challenge. And when I say we, I was a group of about, you know, a dozen people, and then there was some, you know, another dozen people who were outside, you know, I knew them, but they were my friends in the UK. And we were all had gone through a similar stage. So we decided that what we'd do then is go to the Andes and to Patagonia in 1975. And we went there for 9 months, climbed in Patagonia, and then in Peru and Bolivia, and we had a fantastic time. And that was on the Games Climbers Play. This was a significant development in our training and our adaptation to the mountain environment, the serious mountain environment, which enabled us to accept the risks, shall we say. And then when we came back from that, we went on our first Himalayan expedition. And that was very true with not just myself, but with quite a number of other teams, two or three teams doing exactly that. And the way we thought about it was, to certainly in danger, is that if you're on a big expedition, there might be 12 of you, and you go away for a month. Well, if you look at the number of man days that you are exposed to the dangers of the mountain, it's mm-hmm. it's a lot, isn't it? Yeah.
Right.
Whereas if there's just two or four of you, like we were starting to do in the Alps, and you go away and do a fast ascent in Peru or the Himalayas, you're only perhaps going 2 times 8 days or 4 times 8 days. So it's a massively smaller number of days that you're exposing yourself to the dangers of the high mountains. So we thought, oh, well, this is safer. And not only that, it was far more satisfying because we all got to the top or we all failed. So we were like a cohesive group of people with one aim, and we either failed or succeeded together, as it were, which was a lot better than we thought than the big style expedition. I mean, I'd never been on a big style expedition. I wasn't invited. And that's the other thing, you know, by only four of you going out, these big expeditions of Bonington's cost tens of thousands of pounds that to raise sponsorship money for. Whereas only a few of you went out, you know, international travel was starting to expand. The jumbo jet had been invented, and, you know, we could jump on a plane with a rucksack full of gear and go to the Himalayas without all the hullabaloo of a massive international sponsored expedition. And that's what we started to do. And it wasn't just us in the UK. There was French people doing it, American people doing it. There was a general movement. And the key date, really, was the last expedition, this Southwest Face of Everest in 1975. And even Bonington and people like Haston and Doug Scott especially, they changed from these big Himalayan trips to the smaller trips. So this movement, of which you correctly pointed out, was called Alpine style, was what a lot of this book is about.
Yeah, you're writing about a small community of folk there in a way. I mean, I during that period, I think I used to drink in the White Lion in Sheffield, and bumped into Alan Rouse and Paul Nunn and Rab Carrington during that time. That was quite surreal in a way, because these were the giants of Himalayan climbing, for me at least at the time, you know. And I was rubbing shoulders with them, and I'd just fallen off a V-diff in Stanage, you know what I mean? It was a bit different.
Yeah, yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Go on.
Well, exactly. I mean, the book, right, in 2019, just going back to the book, I started thinking, my memory was sort of like fading from this era, and I thought, well, that's a pity. I'd really like to put something down and start writing about
it. Yeah.
And I started writing about a few chapters, and eventually thought, right, I'm going to write a book. And then luckily I managed to get a place in the Banff Wilderness Writing Program, which gave me the confidence, because I'd never written a book like this before.
Right.
And so I came up with the idea that eventually that I would write about 11 of my friends who had I tied a rope to, on the other end of the rope with, who were no long, sadly, no longer with us, and tell the story through my association with those. In other words, they were telling the story rather than me.
All right,
And
okay.
so that is what I've done. And I looked at the significant people I climbed with, and of which seven had died in the mountains, and four had died either of natural causes or by their own hand. And so each chapter of the book really is my experiences with one of those characters. And like you mentioned, these characters, two of the characters are people who you mentioned, who you met, Alan Rowse and Paul Nunn. And of course, Rab Carrington comes, he's alive and well and kicking. And he's one of the, key people within the book, because these are the people I climbed with on the expeditions. And so I, for example, I met Alan Rowse in my first year at Leeds University in 1969. He was the climbing partner, my roommate at Leeds University, and he coincidentally moved to Cambridge University. And as there was no climbing down in Cambridge, really, he used to come up to Leeds and climb with first my roommate, but then my roommate sort of gave up climbing and he started climbing with me. So Al's story is woven through the book, because he
Nice.
was my best mate. And really, the book finishes with Al's death on K, coming down from the summit of K2 in 1986, which was absolutely devastating for me, because I'd been on numerous trips with Al. We went to South America together. Well, before that, we climbed in the Alps. We climbed the Alps in winter. We went to South America together. We climbed Jano and Nuptse together. We went on Everest in winter together. And the Ogre too, and that where Paul Nunn came along as well. So it's all about these people and what made them, I'm trying to analyze through their actions and my interaction with them why they climbed, why Joe Tasker, for example, was such a brilliant Himalayan climber, and yet he hardly climbed in Britain. What gave him that massive push, this obsession with success and climbing mountains, and why that ended up on high, almost near the summit of Everest when he died, or with Pete Boardman. What made him do that? Why was he obsessed? Alex McIntyre was a friend of mine at Leeds University. There's another person who brilliant climber, and why did we all do this dangerous sport? Because what I analysed was that when I looked at the expeditions I went on, the people I went with, the people who lived and the people who died, I had a 1 in 6 chance of dying, the statistics said, and that's the same as Russian roulette. And I'm certainly not a person who would play the game of Russian roulette. And yes, I played the game of Himalayan and big alpine style mountaineering. So why? Why did I do that?
What I mean, you always think, something from my a lot less adventurous climbing, but you always feel that it'll not happen to you until, of course, it does. Then you that sort of changes your perspective. What do you think then drove, I mean, to people to take the ex really extreme risks that they were taking during that time?
Well, it wasn't as though that time the big expeditions were massively safe at that time. For example, at that time, statistics show us that for every three people that got to the summit of Annapurna, one died.
Wow.
Every 10 people who got to the summit of Everest, one died. And coincidentally, that's the same ratio of people who died in the First World War, in the Battle of the Somme. today these mountains are a lot safer because of weather forecasting,
Yeah.
use of, lots of planning. So Everest now, for every 100 people who get to the summit, one person dies. So it has changed a little bit. So it's not as though when we started going into the Himalayas and the greater ranges, it wasn't as though, hey, it's safe, let's go. It was dangerous. But we thought alpine style was safer because what I said, we were exposed to
Yes.
less days when we were up there. And we were quite cocky. We thought we were, fitter, stronger. We were able to climb harder. We've been training a lot in Scotland and in the Alps in summer and rock climbing, and our standards were rising. And significantly, we were all in our 20s. And what you said about you don't think it's going to be, you who's going to die, that's exactly what you think when you're younger. We didn't discuss mortality. We didn't discuss mortality. We were cock-a-hoop. We were, and during the 70s, nobody died. And this endorsed our belief that what we were doing was safer. But then the 80s came, and suddenly lots of people started dying. It was terrible. Pete Thexton on Broad Peak, Alex McIntyre on Annapurna, Joe Tasker and Pete Boardman on Everest, Al Rous on K2, the list goes on and on and on. And I think what the way I analyze it is, in the book, and this is just my own feeling. I mean, anybody else can happily, have their own opinion. But we there's two schools of thought about the way you adapt, the way that you climb and think about the risks involved in the Alps and in the Himalayas. And that is, you can do what I mentioned in the when we talked about games climbers play. In other words, you build your confidence, you adapt to the environment, just as you adapt to the cold. If you go walk out on a cold day, it's bloody freezing. God, it's really cold. But once you start activating on your walk or your climb, you get used to it, don't you? And the same way, you get used to danger. You get used to height. You get used to exposure. And the first lightning bolt is very frightening. But after the storm, when the storm's raging around you, you've sort of got, well, I have anyway. I've got used to it. So this adaption, almost like a Darwinian survival of the fittest, or almost like the Victorians had. Nietzsche saying that what doesn't kill me makes me stronger, sort of attitude, is one thing that climbers, and certainly we were in the 20s, were following, and so we got more and more confident that we could climb these mountains, and not only that, rather than in the big expeditions where people would only go on an expedition every 2 or 3 years, we were going on three expeditions a year. Now that gave us a lot of confidence. It gave us a lot of skill and a lot of knowledge. And so people like Ed Visters, who's a top American Himalayan climber, he really believes that's the case, that he is better and safer climbing in the mountains, because he's become adapted to the mountains. And yet Dave Roberts, another American, wrote the exact opposite. He says, no, that's rubbish. It's pure chance. You can't sort of dictate what is going to happen with the objective dangers of the mountains. And so there's two schools of thought. One which we had, certainly when we were in our 20s, in the 70s, when nothing was going wrong. But then when things started going wrong, we started looking at our own mortality. And we thought, well, things are going wrong. What's happening here? And things like the death of Alex McIntyre, he was paranoid about stone fall. It started from when he did his significant ascent on the Grand Jorasse Central Couloir. One of the attempts before they actually climbed it, he said that there was rock fall the size of fridges coming down. you know.
Right.
And so he had a long paranoia about stonefall in the mountain. And on Annapurna, he was killed by a single stone.
Yeah,
falling from height. It wasn't. There wasn't. It was hardly any stonefall, but one stone just found his head, and that was it. It was pure chance. And avalanche victims, many avalanche victims, it's very much pure chance. Dougal Haston dying in Les Andes, Paul Nunn and Jeff Teer, when Paul died, they were just on their holidays doing a really nice little peak in the Karakoram, and you know, just a remote chance of a serac fall in an avalanche, and they were engulfed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I come to the conclusion that although at the time in my 20s I thought we were adapting, I think, you know, it's mainly chance that people die. And the issue that made it worse for us, why so many people started dying, the fact that we were starting to go several times a year, the fact that our ability was improving, so we were going on to harder, steeper, bigger faces.
Right. Right.
Counteracted our adaptation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You were putting yourselves at greater risk, really, for longer periods. And if you do that, I guess, you know, you lose this game of chance every now and again.
But exactly that. And well, but then I take it a stage further. So in the book High Risk, I'm analysing this, and then I start thinking, well, you know, it's one of the things that happens as you get older is that you become, well, I certainly became more risk averse. So in other words, I became more aware of the risks. And when you become more aware of the risks, you become frightened. You know, you start analysing, you know, do I want to go here? Do I want to go there? You know, a good friend of mine put it succinctly as well. Well, actually, I'll tell you that in a minute, because there's other things that affect you when you get older. I mean, you get start taking more responsibilities on life.
Mm.
Typically, you might, you know, have a fall in love and have a permanent partner. You know, especially in your late 20s and early 30s, you know, early 30s, and you perhaps buy a house, you buy a car, you get a dog, you know. You get a job that, you know, you can only take a certain time out. And all these things are anchors that have been thrown out that stop you going into the mountains. And and so, you know, a friend of mine who's, his name was John Porter, and, you know, he stopped significant Himalayan climbing at a similar time to me, because he was sat there on a bivouac, you know, freezing, you know, and looking at the summit of the mountain. And before he went to sleep, all he could hear in his mind was his two daughters shouting out, "Daddy, daddy."
Mm.
It's really powerful, isn't it, really? You know, how things
adapt.
And so the book analyzes this style, and it really, you know, when in 1986, on the expedition that we went to K2, our Rouse died, I'd had enough. You know, that was the end of my time of high altitude mountaineering, high altitude alpinism. I did go after that, but I wanted to go when I was back in Britain. But when I got out to the Patagonia or the Indian Himalayas or whatever, I just couldn't climb. It wasn't until I went back to K2 on a film job, when I had a thoroughly miserable time, that I was. Knew that I was kidding myself. I knew I couldn't climb in the Himalayas anymore, and that was my, you know, my time when I say, well, you know, that's the end, really, and that's sort of the end of the book, really. Me, that's realization that my mind, you know, and my body has finished this fantastic 15 years of exploring the high mountains, which had gave me so much pleasure. But you know, my time had finished, really. I wasn't able to take the risks anymore. And, you know, the subtitle of the book, High Risk Climbing to Extinction, you know, it really summarizes that, because as the era went on, as this period from 70 to 86 went on, more and more that people died, and this era, this what was called the golden age, was labelled the period when climbers climbed themselves to extinction, and that was given by Rick Silverman, who was the director at the time of the Telluride Mountain Film Festival, and I think it's a very apt name for this era. It's a bit morbid, but I think it's true.
Yeah. So I mean, it sounds a fascinating book about a unique period, really, in the history of mountaineering. And I can understand what you're saying. I think that to display that level of commitment to climb at that level is something that you can only do. I suppose you can only do if you're prepared to be profoundly selfish as well. And that may be sometimes with the events of life and relationships and children, that kind of comes to an end after a while, isn't it? As indeed the era that you're talking about, that you've written about, came to an end.
Yes. I mean, most people, the key word is most. I mean, some people, you know, are still fantastically, you know, resilient. I mean, Bonington carried on.
Yeah, he did.
You know, to quite an age, as did Doug Scott. And if you look at some of the people who are climbing at the moment, Paul Ramsden and Mick Fowler and people like that, they're now in their 40s and 50s and a bit older.
Yes,
and
indeed.
They're still climbing amazing things. So you know, there's it's not a universal rule. And I think that, you know, it's indicative, really, because if we take it a stage further, you know, the hope of true mountaineering now is in the hands of these talented younger climbers who are going out. They tend to be focusing on 6,000 and 7,000 meter peaks without going to the really high peaks, the 8,000 meter peaks, and doing new routes on those steep faces, which were, you know, it was unimaginable what the abilities and what they're doing now. And so the future of mountaineering lies in their hands. But sadly, the public's face of mountaineering now looks at all these crazy commercial expeditions, which have reverted back to what we tried to get away from. So it's gone full circle.
Yeah.
So now that these big commercial expeditions to Everest, Manaslu, Amadablam and whatever, where 80% of the people who go to Nepal are actually now guided rather than going by themselves like it was when we were there, they are really destroying the good name of what I thought was adventure mountaineering. Because an adventure and mountaineering should have an uncertain outcome, and it should have a level of danger. And that's a definition of an adventure to me. And they're trying to say, oh, it's totally safe and you're bound to get to the top. And that's why you're going to pay $50,000 or $100,000, and you're going to not have the adventure. You're going to sit in comfortable tents with sofas and TV and, you know, and whatever. And it's completely different ball game to what it was when I was active there.
Well, thanks, Brian. That was really interesting. And you know, to hear someone who has lived through that era and has got a fantastic insight into it, into that unique period, is really fascinating. So I'm sure that a lot of people will really enjoy your book, High Risk, and I wish you all the best with it. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, John, and I hope it was interesting.